Accession number 20466, Reel 1.
John Burgess, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Winchester.
Which year was this?
In 1926.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Winchester?
Yes, I was born in Winchester and went to school in Winchester until I was called as a Bevin boy.
And which school did you go to there?
I started at All Saints Junior School and then went to Denmark Central School in Winchester.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
So that was 1940?
Yes.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh yes, yes. One Sunday morning, going home from Sunday school.
Did it have any effect on you at all? Did you have any reaction to it at that age?
I think at that stage there was a tinge of excitement because we realised in the south of England we could have been in the front of things, and there was a bit of excitement about, I think, on that particular day.
Did the war affect you at first?
It did, in as much as Winchester became sort of one of the front lines. There was compulsory billeting. My mother had to take soldiers in, and the house was always full, and the place was sort of alive with the military, really. So it did affect us as children, yes.
How did the soldiers behave in the house?
Oh, excellently. We were fortunate that we had number 4 commando unit, which was Lord Lovett's units, and they left home for several days at a time and went on raids and visits and came back, and they were very, very nice people, very nice chaps.
Was there any bombing that you were in?
Winchester itself avoided the bombing. We had one occasion when bombs were dropped, but I think it was inadvertently, because it was always said that Hitler was going to be crowned in Winchester Cathedral, and it was one of the places it was always avoided. Although Southampton was badly hit, and my father was a fireman and spent nights and days and away from home fighting fires in Southampton, and of course we weren't very far away from that.
Did you suffer any deprivations in the war?
Not that I can remember. I mean, we people weren't so well off as they. We seemed to feed all right, and there was always a meal on the table. And I don't think I can, as I remember, many deprivations. No.
So rationing didn't affect you very much?
Well, it must have done, but I mean, I was only a young boy, and my mother always managed to put a meal on. Father was a gardener. We always had a big garden. There was a field at the back of the house, which was let off for more allotments, and more things were grown, and we kept chickens and ducks and God knows what. So really, there was always a meal on the table.
What were you hoping to happen to you later in the war?
Well, I worked, when I first left school, at the Royal Naval Air Station at Worthy Down. And I worked in the stores there from sort of 14 till I was called up. And I cherished the idea of becoming a sailor or in the Fleet Air Arm.
What happened in the event?
In the event, of course, when I became old enough to go and have my medical, I went to Southampton and went in front of the medical board and passed A1. And just on my 18th birthday, I received notification that I'd been drawn out in the ballot for the Bevin boys, and my destination was going to be the mining industry and not the armed forces, which was a disappointment, but nevertheless, that's how things turned out.
Did you protest against it?
I didn't protest at the time because I really didn't, I suppose, didn't know how to protest it in those days. That was you did as you were told. And I was 18 on the 31st of August, and I left home for the mining industry the first week in September. So it happened fairly quickly.
Can you tell me about the journey from your home, please?
Oh, very much so. Living in Winchester, the war was on. London was a city in those days a long, long way away. I'd only been on day trips. I'd certainly never been north of London, and I'd never seen a coal mine. And I remember getting on the train at Winchester to go to Waterloo, and feeling a bit bewildered because I didn't know how I was going to get from Waterloo to St Pancras to continue my journey up to Chesterfield, where I was supposed to go. And in fact, a seaman who I'd got to know through my Royal Naval Air Station experiences was on the train and he guided me. So that was one big help to get across to St Pancras. And then a train from St Pancras, a steam train from St Pancras, up to Chesterfield, which was absolutely packed to the gunwales in those days. And standing room only all the way. We arrived in Chesterfield at tea time and got off the train, and of course I spotted several other young men like in the same situation as myself, dragging their suitcases away to report to the Labour Exchange where we were to go to be deployed.
What did they say at the Labour Exchange?
Well, we went from there, they laid a bus on, and there was a training centre at Cresswell Colliery, which is in North Derbyshire, and we went across to Cresswell. And we were billeted in Nissen huts, 12 to a hut, where we received our month's training. Some of it underground, some of it on the surface, doing physical exercises and trying to build ourselves up a bit, I suppose. But it's quite an experience.
What did you think to the training?
It was an experience. I'd never seen a coal mine before, never mind going down one. And on our first trips down, we were all boys together, so that you don't show any fear, of course, and I suppose we soon got used to it. It was a new experience, something we'd never seen before, and we took it all in.
Was it good quality training?
I don't suppose it was in those days. It was a question, it was basic training. I mean, you're very difficult in a month to get acclimatised to the underground experience that we were to endure at the colliery to which we were sent eventually after completing our training.
What kind of warnings did they give you in the training?
Well, we were to be employed mainly on haulages, which was, the coupling runs of coal, runs of tubs of coal onto the ropes, and in fact some of us ended up pony driving, and they were telling us not to put our hands on top of the tubs in case our fingers got chopped off, and not to get between the tubs because we might get crushed, and all sorts of basic safety things that to keep ourselves free from danger. Of course we were equipped with safety boots and a helmet and a lamp on our underground visits, but they weren't electric, they were the old-fashioned bucket lamps, not the new cap lamps that they wear today. You slung them between your knees and made the best of your way.
Were they effective underground?
Oh yes, everybody was in the same boat, everybody was the same, and I suppose the experience that it was, we coped with it.
Where were you living whilst you were doing the training?
At Cresswell, we were there was a constructed training centre. There was 12 of us in it. There were Nissen huts, and there were 12 of us to a hut. And then the miners' welfare, which was just across the way, the upstairs room was turned into a gymnasium. And we went up there after we finished our underground experience and went up there for gymnasium and build our strengths up.
What kind of boys were with you? Were they all conscripts?
All of us. Oh yes, everyone was conscripts. We were in groups of 12. There was a lad from Saffron Walding in Essex. There was one from London. There was one from Oxford. So a fairly old group of us.
Mainly from the south of England, then?
Yes, mainly from the south of England. I think the reason for that was that most of the local boys, if you like, were employed in the mines because they were exempt from national service. So there weren't many Bevin boys from the mining areas because they already worked in the pits.
What happened at the end of your training period?
We were asked where we would like to go, if we had any particular choice of colliery. Of course, not knowing much about the mining industry and not knowing where the collieries were, I asked if I could stay in the Nottingham area, and I was sent on a train to Annesley Colliery, which is in just north of Nottingham. And I started there, I suppose, at the end of October 1944. I then went while I was working at Annesley, I went and stayed in the miners' hostel at Hocknor, where there was probably seven or eight Nizzen huts. We were again 12 to a hut with showers, and we used to catch the bus to the colliery every morning, or depending what shift we were on. There was 12 of us in a room, some of them on the day shift, some of them on afternoon shift, and some of them on night. So it was always a busy room. You never got much rest.
How far was it between Hocknor and Annesley?
About 6 miles.
How do you spell Annesley?
Annesley.
No R in the middle?
No.
Can you tell me about the features of Annesley coal mine, please?
Well, Annesley was a medium-sized colliery, and as it happened, to become a very friendly place. I mean, we were made welcome. There was a lot of Bevin boys who were unfortunate and weren't received very well because they thought they were doing their own local lads out of a job, although that wasn't the case. But I do know that some of them weren't received very well. But Annesley was a very, very friendly place, and we were made most welcome. In fact, I stayed there all the while. I stayed in the hostel for about 8 or 9 months, and eventually got some lodgings with a couple in Hocknor, and I lived with them, in fact, until I got married.
Was that better than being in a hostel?
Oh yes, certainly, yes. I mean, it was like really like being at home. She looked after us well, she fed us well. Two of us stayed there, she fed us well. It was looked after very, very well indeed.
Was Annesley a deep pit?
Annesley was, yes, about 800 yards, and fairly deep. We worked the deep soft seam, which wasn't very thick, about a yard thick. But of course, when I started there, I wasn't trained for the coal face. We either worked on the haulage, or we were pony driving. In fact, my first job was pony driving, and they filled the tubs of coal at the end of the face, and we gang them away, as they call it, with a pony down to the main haulage where they were clipped on and sent to the pit bottom. And quite an experience.
Were ponies easy to handle?
Oh yes, there was a lot. In those days, there were a lot of ponies. Annesley must have had between 50 or 60. And you had the same one every day, so you got to know your pony. And I think the pony got to know you. It was quite a relationship. We were always, ponies were always selected to go to the royal shows, and a big fuss was made every year to get a particular pony fit and ready to be brought out of the mine for a special occasion.
Where were these shows?
All the local shows, you know, the local agricultural shows, including the royal show at Warwick. Or pit ponies were always shown at the local shows, or you know, the agricultural show, like the Yorkshire show at Harrogate, or the one at the Coventry show. Wherever there were mines, ponies were shown at the shows.
What colour were the ponies?
Oh, there was a really assortment. There was no particular colour. They were usually selected for the size and strength, stamina.
Were they well treated or not down the pit?
Oh yes, they were well treated. The stables were always warm, they were always well fed, and they always looked well. We brought them out of the pit for the fortnight's holiday. That was quite an experience as well. But they were well looked after.
Why was it such an experience?
Well, they were liberated. I suppose when you've been down in the dark for 50 weeks of the year, you come out into the daylight and into the rain and the wind, and they used to jump and run about and prance, and it was the whole village used to turn out to watch the ponies being brought up the pit. Quite an experience.
Were they easy to handle once you got them back down again?
Sometimes it was a bit of a struggle to catch them, to get them to go back down again, but they soon got used to it again. Yeah, pretty well trained.
How did they do their work down the pit?
Well, in those days, I mean, at Annesley, they filled the tubs at the end of the coal face, coupled them together in sets of four or six, depending on the size of or the steepness of the roadway, or the size of the tubs, and the ponies were clipped onto the end and driven away, accompanied by a lad, and then down into the main haulage, where they were clipped onto a rope and sent back probably 2 or 3 miles to the pit bottom. Yes.
Would they know their way around the pit?
Oh, yes. They knew the way, yes. Especially, the lads used to say they could count. You could stand the pony there in front of the front tub, and they used to say when the sixth one was clipped on, the pony knew he was ready for going. And if somebody put seven on, he wouldn't go. You can believe. We always said the ponies could count. It was incredible, really. But one of the stories of the pits.
Do you think it was true?
I think there was an element of truth in it. I mean, they knew what they were capable of doing. And if you asked them to do too much, they wouldn't do it. And I think there was an element of truth in it.
But you said the other job that you did was haulage?
Yes, the haulage was a mechanical haulage, of course, a long wire rope, probably in some cases above a mile long, and the tubs were clipped onto them in runs of six, with a clip at either end, or a chain at either end, and sent away on their journey down the main road to the pit bottom, where they'd be unclipped, and then another set of boys would push them onto the chair, to the cage, up the pit, empties coming down against it, and the empties would be shoved off on the other side and back in onto the other side of the rope, back to the loader end again. So it was more or less continuous mining in there.
Did you ever have any accidents?
Oh, yes. Not personally, but I mean there was accidents. Yes, lads would get arms broken or feet crushed. Or there would be nothing really serious, but there would be accidents. Yes, the coal face was the dangerous place, of course, in those days.
How did being underground affect your health?
It never affected me. I mean, I've always been fairly very active, and I've kept myself accident free, and I don't think it's really affected my health. I've probably been a fortunate one.
Did you have any difficulty with breathing down there?
No. The only difficulty I had, because I'm 6'3", so I was a little bit tall to become a miner, but I coped. It's just one of those things you learn to deal with.
Were most miners short?
Yeah, most miners are short, yeah.
Why was it that you couldn't work on the pit face?
Well, I did eventually work on the pit face, but it's a question of experience and time. You know, you have to graduate through the various trainings and experiences, and at the end of the day, you can get yourself onto the coal face. There again, you undergo another series of training. Of course, in those days, coal face work was more manual than it is today. Coal was cut by a machine, fired down with explosives, and then hand-loaded onto the conveyors men with shovels, and then they set their own roof supports. So it was quite intensive training, but mainly looking after yourself. And you graduated to that as you get older and as the occasion arose. And of course, some people made a career of being on the haulage. Not everybody wanted to be a coalface worker. But that was how it happened. I decided fairly early on that I was going to stay in the mines. I'd met the lady who was to become my wife, and I decided I was going to stay. And so my ambition was to get onto the coalface and get some experience and some more money, of course. And then I decided that if I was going to do that, then I would study and at least become an underground official. So I went to night school, and after I became a coalface worker, and my first qualification was to become a shot firer. He's the chappie that fires the follows the cutter down after the coalface has been cut, and fires the shots. And then after that, to become a deputy. A deputy is the man who acts underground in charge of a particular district, in charge of the men, which eventually I did.
Why was it that you decided to go in for a career in mining?
Mainly because the time came when Bevin boys were to be discharged, or told that they were no longer wanted, for a better word. And I know I was courting at the time. I'd met my wife, but to go back to Winchester and to start, I hadn't got a career to go back to. There was nothing to go back to, really. So I decided that at least in the coal industry, there was a chance, and I did develop an interest for mining. So it was when the decision was made, really. I became an underground official, and kept up with my studies. And in 1954, the Coal Board offered me a year's full-time study to obtain a national diploma in mining and my colliery manager certificate, which I got in 1955. So once I'd got that qualification, it was just a question then of, working as best I could and seeking some further promotion.
Can we just go back to Bevin Boy days? You said that you wanted to work on the face. Did you eventually work on the face at Annesley?
Oh, yes.
What kind of jobs were you doing on the face there?
Well, you start off doing your training, which in those days you were sent under the supervision of a collier who sort of taught you all the basic rules of best way to get the coal, to load it onto the conveyor, and to set your roof supports, and to do things safely. And then after a period of days, I think it was probably about 60 days in those days, 60 days of training, you were qualified to take a coal yourself. And eventually I worked through until I was able to do a full task on the coal face. And obviously, to become qualified as an underground official, you have to do 2 years on or about the coal face. So it was all a part of sort of furthering yourself. It's something you'd got to do.
But you said in those days on the face it was mainly manual?
Oh yes, definitely.
What did it consist of?
Well, you got there in the coal was prepared for you. I mean, the coal was undercut on one shift with a cutting machine to the depth of about 4 foot 6 to 5 foot. You got there in the morning, all the small coal that the cutter left behind had to be loaded out onto the conveyor. Then the shot firer came along and you retired to a safe place while he fired your coal out down into sort of manageable pieces, and then you went back with a shovel and a pick and a hammer and loaded, in those days, 10 yards of coal, a yard thick and 4'6" deep. And as you went along, you set your roof supports, made sure you were safe, until the end of the day, a team of you, probably about 20 men on a coal face, would have advanced that coal face by the depth of the undercut, 4'6" to 5 foot. And then after that, another team would come on the afternoon shift, and they would dismantle the conveyor that you'd load onto and bring that forward into the next track, and ready for the night shift coming on again to go through and cut it through again. So there was, apart from the filling operation, there was the coal cutting, and there was we called them turners. They were the people that went and broke the conveyor up and laid it forward into a new track the following shift. So it was a 24-hour cycle, and that was the early days of hand-filled coal. I mean, it was universal, and it wasn't until after the war when we started using armoured conveyors and coal cutting machines.
Armoured conveyors?
Yes, armoured conveyors are conveyors which can be snaked forward like a snake. In fact, in the early days, we used to call them pythons. conveyor was made of steel with a steel band and steel chains and flights, an endless conveyor. And the coal cutting machine sat on top of it, and as the coal cutting machine went through the face and loaded the coal itself, the men behind would push the conveyor over into a new track because it snaked, and bring the supports forward. Entirely different method of getting coal, of course.
What if the task wasn't completed in the 24 hours?
Well, invariably it was. I mean, there were occasions when, due to an out-by delay or a conveyor breakdown or a haulage breakdown, the task wasn't completed on a particular shift, then people would double up or stay over until the task was completed. But, I mean, it was everybody's intention to get the task completed, of course. We were paid on task, even if it meant some overtime.
So, were you paid by time or by piece?
Paid by piece. Task work. When the Nottinghamshire, I can't remember now when the day wage came in. Must have been in the '50s. When everybody got onto the day wage. But nevertheless, that, you know, it was everybody's intention to complete the task as quickly as they could.
Were Bevan boys paid the same as?
Oh yes, they were at Annesley. I know, as I said before, I mean, Nottinghamshire pits tended to be a little bit more generous than some of the others, but we were paid the same as everybody else.
Generous to whom?
Well, we were paid on a day wage, especially on the haulage particularly, whereas some of the pits down in particularly in Staffordshire, were paid on a butty system, where the butty received the money from the firm. In those days, it was pre-nationalisation, and he paid his staff himself. They called him a butty. He was like a foreman who received a lump sum to pay his team. And not everybody was paid the same. But in Nottinghamshire, the butty system didn't work. We were paid directly from the company.
Were you ever frightened down the pit as far as when you were a Bevan boy?
Oh, yes, I think, there's many times in my career when I've been frightened. Never mind as a Bevan boy, but obviously as a Bevan boy, when things happen, you you weren't quite aware of why it was happening. I mean, we had falls of roof, we had